Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we're speaking with Rajul Garg, who is the founder and managing partner of Leo Capital, a seed and early stage fund investing in tech companies out of India or comprised of Indian entrepreneurs. Rajul, thanks for joining us today. You and I have known each other for 20 years, so I'm really excited to actually spend some time for our audience to get to know you as well as I have. Tell us a little bit about your background and where you grew up and all that kind of stuff.
So Thanasis and Jennifer, thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast. I'm super excited for many reasons, but the biggest one is what you said. We've known each other for 20 years, so it's always good to do this with friends and people and have worked with. So my background, I actually grew up in India, in different parts of Northern India. My father was in what in India is called a government job, which means that you keep getting posted from one city to the other. Typically, it's a three-year posting. So I saw most part of North India, but it was all tier two and rural India. And I got into college in Delhi. So I went to IIT Delhi, which is like a top-notch engineering school in Delhi. And usually kids from there get good jobs and start become entrepreneurs and stuff like that. So it's really a launching pad for many folks who go there. So I came out of that and I had an unusual path in 1998 when I graduated. Entrepreneurship was not quite the thing to do, but I did choose to become an entrepreneur in 1998 from my college dorm room. And it so happened, just one of those things that my roommate actually had an uncle who was an entrepreneur and he had come visiting one day in my final year of graduation. And he just gave an inspirational speech about becoming an entrepreneur and how he had done so well. And I think that's what really inspired me. And I jumped right in and I started my first company from my college dorm called Pine Labs, and the co-founder who joined a year later. And one thing led to another. We got some customers. I had a cousin who was working with one of the big oil companies, and they were looking to get into automation of petrol pumps using smart cards and chip cards. So ended up doing that work for them. So did that for 2 years, and the company was actually doing okay. But as many entrepreneurship journeys, it wasn't really a blockbuster or anything at that point of time. There was no hockey stick. It was just grunt work, linear, 2 years and survival and stuff like that. And during those 2 years, I met my other two co-founders in GlobalLogic, Sanjay and Manoj. So they were actually looking to start what at that time was called IndusLogic and later on became GlobalLogic. They were looking to have an India co-founder, and we had a common friend, and they literally came on a plane to Delhi and were sitting in a hotel lobby interviewing potential co-founders. And we all met. I guess we really liked each other. So they were carrying this report of how B2B is the next big thing and XML was everywhere and stuff like that. And it sounded very exciting. And so all four of us joined hands and started IndusLogic. This was, I think, spring of 2000.
I think that's when we met, or rather late 2000. But GlobalLogic is now a multi-billion dollar value company. And so is Pine Labs, which was spun out of GlobalLogic. So you have given birth to two unicorns, basically, in essence. So briefly talk about what GlobalLogic does now and what Pine Labs does.
Yeah, so GlobalLogic today is a leader in outsourced product development. And it's an outsourcing, offshoring play. But they target the CTOs for new product development versus the traditional CIO for in-house development.
So like an example customer would be what?
Like a Google would be a customer, or a Microsoft would be a customer, right, or Telcordia. Or now
so extending their in-house engineering teams, in essence.
Correct, correct. And it has, I think, over a period of time now graduated to also working for automotive companies, working on new car launches and all that good stuff. Right. So yeah, the company's grown, and as it's a multi-billion dollar company today, but we've all exited somewhere during the journey.
And Pine Labs is also now a unicorn, right, in India?
It is. So Pine Labs, over a period of time, and it has its own journey where it was part of GlobalLogic and then spun off. But now it is, I would say, think of it as a square of India. It's still the machine that sits there is not that square, sexy machine like Square is, but it does the same job. And you see it everywhere. You go to a restaurant, You go to a mall, you go shopping, you see it everywhere, literally 70% chance that you swipe your card and it'll be a Pine Labs machine.
Wow. And so how has your background and experience as an entrepreneur shaped you into the investor that you are today?
I think significantly, Jennifer, I would say, because I'm basically hardcore, homegrown, bottom-up entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And my worldview was always like that. So when I look at my current life as an investor, so the first thing I look at is just a much more bottom-up view of things versus, and then I add on top-down of it. But I think because I've been there in the basement and for quite a few years, like all entrepreneurs, so I think I spend a lot of time with the team and try to understand if they have just the wherewithal and the ability to carry on and build a large company and ability to swallow some pain, see some changes, stuff like that. And also how companies look very early. I understand that how it can be very different from when they grow up a little bit and companies do these days multiple levels of pivoting as they unlock larger market sizes. So I think I'm able to see that very closely. I think what I've seen myself do is that I'm a good deal picker at a very early stage level.
Right.
I think just because of that, I think just assessing the team and the market opportunity very quickly. But it has all been influenced by my experiences.
That makes a ton of sense. So on that note, let's segue into Leo Capital. Tell us a little bit about your strategy, your focus, average check size, all that good stuff.
So Leo Capital was born organically from my angel investing days. So my journey has been entrepreneur to angel investor to fund manager.
Right.
So I was investing my own money for a few years. And then Leo Capital is now 3 years old. We started right at the beginning of Q1 of 2018. So we are an early stage venture capital tech fund, very classical. I wouldn't say, I think not very dissimilar to how NAV was or Draper Atlantic was when they invested into GlobalLogic back in 2000. So our average ticket size is typically 1 to 2 million. We are usually the first institutional investor. We are basically we are a more horizontal fund. So we do all kinds of tech plays. And in India, the tech plays usually are the ones which relate closely to GDP growth, which is things like content, commerce, logistics, fintech, health tech these days, edutech, and more tech and more software is entering these sectors. So that's basically our investment theme, to ride on the India growth story predominantly and invest in these sectors.
And what made you decide to start your own fund? And what was that experience like?
So the journey was more organic for me because I was investing my own money for a few years. Mm-hmm. And it was either become an entrepreneur again or start a fund or join a fund. Those were the realistic options for me at that point of time. And I think starting a fund sounded like a lot of fun. I thought it gave me the right independence and the right exposure to entrepreneurs that I had always relished and enjoyed. Because I think even in GlobalLogic, back in GlobalLogic days, over years, I was shifted to buying companies. So for a few years, I was looking at buying companies, which is again, and that's when my journey of picking entrepreneurs started, actually. And I've been doing that now for 15 years. So I think it felt like a natural next step for me to just step up the game a little bit from an angel to a fund. But I would say still, I did not fully get it. I thought it would be a lot similar, but it ended up being different in some key ways from angel investing. I think first, of course, just the whole aspect of raising a fund. I think I grossly underestimated it. I think we got it done, but it took a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of positioning, a lot of new things that I'd never done. Plus, also, I think fund brings in new kinds of elements to investing versus investing your own money. So I think all that has been actually a good learning exercise and great fun. I think today I feel much more comfortable sitting as a fund manager versus, let's say, 2.5 years back.
Rajul, do you want to give us an example portfolio company and talk to us how you found them and why you were excited and how that fits into your strategy?
Sure. So let me take an example of a company called Bull. So Bull is a Hindi word for canary, the singing bird. Actually, I think it's Arabic origins. And the company started about 2 years back, and it's a serial entrepreneur. So the guy who started it was earlier a co-founder of another internet company, Make My Trip, which is the largest travel company in India. And this was his next thing. And him and I have been friends for many years. He lives in Delhi, and so we've known each other. And he had this new idea of using video in commerce, essentially. So it's a video commerce site versus the Amazon and Flipkarts, which was acquired by Walmart here, are more text-based, just the way Amazon US is. So Bulbul had this new idea because in India, again, only 40, 50 million people are English speaking and they are on the internet or they're buying online. The next 300, 400 million, as they've come online, they don't have this natural behavior of comparison shopping and buying something. They're more window shoppers. So they want to hear something, they want to listen to something, and maybe they'll buy something. So we felt that it fits right into that thesis of internet growth in India and a very seasoned entrepreneur. So we invested in that. We were the first check into that, Seed Check. This one was pre-launched just mainly because of the profile of the entrepreneur and the large market space. The company has gone on to do very well. They've, you know, raised Series A, Series B. They have Sequoia in it now. They have a couple of other large investors in it. But I think that's one of the success stories and right bang into the middle of India growth story. Again, India internet growth story.
And what's the best way to get your interest in new opportunities for a founder to pitch you? What do you look for?
The best way is a referral, like most VCs would tell you, because right. We have a large portfolio at this point of time. And I think one of our founders refers somebody that does get immediate attention. But I do think in India, entrepreneurship is still developing. Mm-hmm. And we do still carry the burden of replying to even cold stuff that comes to us. So we never actually really let it go. So even the cold stuff that comes to us, just cold emails from our website or on LinkedIn and stuff like that, we do actually go through them and make sure that we're not missing out on anything. And we are actually also replying, just being a good citizen,
yep.
Good venture citizen. So we do that. And we just feel it's good karma and comes around in one way or the other. And we learn a lot just sifting through that. So I think the best way though is to come through referral, because that will guarantee you at least a meeting.
So moving into the India ecosystem as a whole, it's the third largest VC ecosystem. I was reading recently that VCs and PEs have pumped about $34.6 billion across 700 deals since the beginning of the year. Talk to us a little bit about the dynamics of VC within India.
So India, I would say the entire VC ecosystem is now about 20 years old. So Sequoia, and I think most global VCs landed here in early 2000s. I would say 2004, 2005. Literally, there was an article in which they were all shown sitting on a boat with Silicon Valley Bank. So there was a guy in Silicon Valley Bank who got them all for a trip to India. I think it was 2004 or 2005. And right after, a lot of VCs, Sequoia, Canaan, you know, Lightspeed, Matrix, a bunch of them, gradually Draper, they started offices here. So that was, I think, the beginning of it. Over a period of time, some of them didn't make it. Some of them have continued to become quite big. Like Sequoia India is quite big, Lightspeed is quite big, Matrix is quite big. And on top of that, a bunch of domestic VC firms like ours have come up as well, you know, which are homegrown, and or some of these have become not 10 years old, 5 years old. So at this point, I would say it's a well-capitalized ecosystem. It's nowhere close to, still nowhere close to Bay Area or China for that matter. I think it's still way smaller than some of these geographies. But for the size of India and the size of entrepreneurship that is happening in India today, it is adequate. There is enough capital going around. You wouldn't find a good company which just died for lack of funding. There are a lot of options. Angel ecosystem has come up quite strongly. Angel List is here in India now with an Indian chapter of it. A bunch of seed funds like ours. So yeah, so I think also what we see in India is a lot of global funds are directly investing. So up until last year, Chinese funds could be seen literally all over the place. If you're sitting in a Starbucks in Bangalore, which is, think of it like a Sandal Road equivalent, you would see funds from China, Korea, Japan, sitting on coffee tables across entrepreneurs listening to pitches, which was a new sight. And I think that continues to happen. China, you know, has stopped investing this year because of government regulation. But other than that, it's still going on. So India is also attracting a lot of global capital. So when you put it all together, there is a lot of buzz here. And also it's a small ecosystem. There's mainly two cities, Delhi and Bangalore. So it's also very concentrated. If you're in these two cities, you will constantly meet a lot of potential investors.
Definitely. And from what I've read, there's been a huge surge of deals, particularly with AngelList.
Yeah, it's been one of those weird years, right? So I think March, Q2 was, of course, quite very quiet. I think April, May, June, but Q3 came back with a vengeance. And you know, Q3 was really active all across the board.
How do the Indian companies fit into the global market? India is obviously a big market in and of itself. And I would imagine most companies start there. But increasingly, you see companies kind of becoming global very quickly. Is that happening in India, or is it still the target is addressing the Indian market? And how does that affect your strategy?
So if you look at the three big ones, US, China, and India, that's how people like to compare, right? So if you look at China, for example, China mainly grew on domestic market. So all the large companies, Alibaba, Tencent, now Pinduoduo, and all these, they've come from domestic market, right? Now, India has its own share of domestic wins because there is a large domestic market. But remember that India also is English speaking, historically, we've had a history of services, just like GlobalLogic, which is now 30, 40 years old. The service industry started in late 70s. So the second segment of Indian companies are companies which are building global software sitting out of India. So these are typically enterprise software companies. So think of a GlobalLogic. We were building product for other companies. Now, over a period of time, companies have started building product for themselves, and they're finding enough.
Moving past the service component, like the Wipros of the world, moving more into product then.
Exactly. So I think that is actually a pretty significant investment theme for most VCs, including us. So outside of the domestic market, that's the second kind of companies that we all invest in. They think of these kids sitting in Bangalore building global software. And there have been now some significant successes like Freshworks, which is like a decacorn in the CRM space, Zoho, another sort of big company. There's a security company. There's at least half a dozen companies, you know, which have gone past a unicorn stage. And new companies have raised, like this year, 100 million, 200 million, building software from India. So it is a significant phenomenon. And that impacts our strategy as well. So we're looking at those companies as well.
And you touched on this a little bit before, but what changes have you seen in the VC ecosystem with COVID? And has that changed your investment focus or deal flow?
So again, initial period of just let's hold back and let's not do anything, which is March, April, early May. But then I think as people saw that the public markets are holding true and holding up, there was just a lot of deal activity. There is, I would say more so at seed and early levels. I would say less so at late stage in India versus again in the US, like this has been just an IPO year, right? There's so many IPOs and late stage investments. We haven't seen that kind of stuff in India, but a lot of early rounds. Sectorally, very similarly, people have shifted to edtech, content, gaming. These are, you know, the top themes for the year. Fintech, I would say, seen a lot of investments again because things have gone more and more cashless. Of course, travel, hospitality, some of these lending kind of things have taken a backseat. And those are the companies which have suffered the most. So not very dissimilar, I would say, to what you've seen in other parts of the world. But all in all, my guess would be that we may have outpaced deal activity from last year, at least in terms of early stage investing.
You touched on this, Rajul, but China, I think of China as a much more tech forward economy. And even though India, ironically, was much earlier into the tech game with the creation of the IITs, it hasn't seen technology being adopted in the domestic market as much as China. Is that right? Is that perception correct? And why is that?
It is correct. And the reason is that the China has a real middle class, right? So of 300 million to 400 million people who have a purchasing power, which is significant, and they can consume products on the internet and make large, huge internet companies. I forget what that band is, but I think that band is like $15,000 to $30,000 of annual income. So China has now 300 million plus people who have that kind of income levels. And that just makes all the difference versus in India, that segment is still small. So that segment is maybe 40, 50 million people. And hence, even though internet has now gone very deep, but the purchasing power is not there. So when you think of large internet products, they're just not able to sell that much beyond the first 40, 50 million. But with GDP growth, this is changing. And over a period of time, as you get a larger and larger middle class, we'll see greater technology adoption. But I think that is the number.
So it's demand driven. It's not really, it doesn't have to do with regulatory or anything like that.
I don't think it's to do with regulatory. I think it is demand driven. Now, Chinese companies also have had government protection, so they've never had to compete with global competitors. Versus India has always been an open market. So Flipkart competed neck to neck with Amazon, Ola competed with Uber and all that, versus Chinese companies had a relatively free run domestically. So that makes it a little bit harder as well for Indian companies to become dominant in that sense. But it has happened. But I think the big reason, if I had to pick, it'll still be demand driven.
And you had mentioned a little bit ago, Chinese investors being blocked. Could you speak a little bit more on that?
Yeah, so on top of all the COVID-related stuff, which has made things bitter with China for many countries, India has also been having a border skirmish. So India, we share a border with China, and there's also been a border skirmish going on now for 4 or 5 months. And it's not, there are some military instances there as well. And I think that has resulted in a greater, I think from both sides, countries have stopped trade much more with each other compared to earlier. So Indian government, for example, banned all Chinese apps earlier this year. So things like WeChat or TikTok, these have become fairly popular in India as well. But like right now sitting in India, I can't use these. They just don't open up on my phone anymore. And on top of that, Indian government also put in a ruling that for Chinese investors to invest in Indian companies, they need a government approval. So it's not automatic, which obviously resulted in a huge reduction in Chinese investments overall. And also there is a, I think there's an emotional undertone and there is all that going on. So in general, there's a huge reduction in Chinese investment to India.
What does the startup ecosystem in India look like to you, if you could predict it 5 to 10 years from now?
I think it's a really thriving ecosystem. When I go back to my school, let's say, which is about 10 miles from where I'm sitting right now, literally everybody wants to become an entrepreneur. Like, this was not the case when I graduated. I was the only entrepreneur in my entire class. These days, there's a large number of students who are doing it. And even if they're not doing it right away, they may do it 2 years, 3 years down the line. So it's very much on the mind of most of the top students. And there's just a huge number of startups coming up altogether. Right. Every year, every quarter, we get 150 new startups every month, just at the top of the funnel. And we are a small fund and not that well known versus compared to the large funds. So there's just a lot of deal activity. Combine this with the availability of capital, GDP growth. The government is aiming to double the GDP by 2025. It's been a setback here, but they're hoping
for
to
us
make
all.
It up. For everyone. But they are hoping to make it up. So I think when you combine that and then you combine with internet growth, internet is now truly with 600-700 million Indians, and it's literally in everyone's hands. So when you combine all these factors, I do think we will see continued growth in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. In 5-10 years, it should look somewhere between, India has its own uniquenesses. So some elements of China with large domestic winners, but also some elements of global software players coming out of China. I think it's going to be a combination of these two, but very vibrant, I'd say.
So from a US investor's perspective, do you think that the huge tech growth that you saw maybe in the US, is that ahead of us in India, or has it already happened?
Beginning of it. We're not even, I would say, halfway there. So it's the whole tech growth domestically is only last 7-8 years story. So we have a long way to grow. So I do think it's easy to go long on India for all tech investments and generally. I think in India, the devil lies in the details. You can go long, but sometimes it can be frustrating how long it takes. Sometimes it takes longer than you think, and 2 years become 3 years and 4 years. You have to see what is really taking off, where the momentum is. But if you're long, you really can't go wrong.
Got it.
So switching gears into our 4 standard question segment, this is something that we do with every podcast, just as a way to get to know you on a more personal level. We're looking forward to hearing your answers. So question 1 is, if you could have a magic wand and change or improve something about the VC industry, what would it be and why?
So I think VC industry, just the way the asset classes can only touch upon a limited number of companies. And it picks out like the very high growth, companies which can, again, the mothership for all venture industry tends to be Bay Area. So everything tends to be modeled around that. And these days, people are not even happy with a unicorn. They want decacorns and IPOs of 40 billion, 50 billion. So that, I think particularly when you extrapolate to a country like India, that's really hard to do. We just don't have the depth in most of the markets to get that far that quickly. I think a little bit more regionalization of venture, I would say, would help, where, like, for example, a $1 billion company in India is really large. It's right. Very hard to build and should offer pretty good returns. So I think a little bit more regionalization and understanding of local nuances, because you can't compare apple to apple. It's just, there's no $50 billion startup in India so far. Maybe it'll change, but today there's none. And versus US seems to be producing them every couple of weeks these days through their IPOs. So
right. Number 2, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I would probably be a gamer. I was just big time into video games when I was growing up. And tier 2 India, there wasn't that much choice. So there was Nintendo, basically.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Super Mario. I don't know if you ever
played
that.
Every day.
And arcade games. But I never thought, if somebody had asked me in grade 7, I would have said, I love games and I'd probably be a gamer. And I think today you can be a gamer, I think, and still do okay for yourself. So I'd probably be a gamer if I weren't PC.
That's awesome. I love it. So number 3 is, who is someone you look up to and why?
So this is a hard one. There are just so many people, and especially in our entrepreneurial community, there's so much to get inspired by. Sometimes by resilience, sometimes by just sheer positivity, sometimes by just intellect, sometimes by ability to lead teams. It's just so hard to pick one. So I'm gonna say mostly by our entrepreneurs, but there's just so much to get inspired by. I just could not pick one. I thought about it long enough.
No, I totally understand. That's a great answer too. And lastly, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I would say one of the The best piece of advice I would say, or one advice that I remember, is just more focusing on the work that you're doing versus kind of the output that you're producing. You know, I mean, because there's so much going on and there's so much uncertainty in today's world, particularly that there's so many things that you can't control. I learned to keep my head down and keep focusing on the stuff that I'm good at and back myself. Right. Versus, I think in the VC world, it's easy to get FOMO when you're looking at all these big rounds that are happening and all that. But I think I've learned to keep my head down and just focus on and back myself and focus on my strengths.
Yeah, that's great. What advice would you have for founders, particularly right now?
I would say hang in there more than anything else. On one hand, you hear of all these rounds happening and all that, but that's not true for everyone. And I know there are many founders who are in serious pain. If they have money, they don't have the business to support it. The business is still coming back. The main street is still suffering. So I would say just hang in there. And again, I would give the same advice. Just keep your head down and hang in there. It'll all get better.
Rajul, thank you very much for joining us today. We enjoyed learning a lot more about India and I guess the promise of India for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed that.
And follow us on Twitter at ProofVC or on our website at proof.vc. Thank you.